The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. As you might have guessed, this week's episode is all about urbanism and football.
The float's strangeness, at least as a football field, is twofold. One, and there is, yes, a clue in the name, is that it floats.
As fans around the world prepare for the opening whistle in Russia, we too have been infected by World Cup fever. Well, some people have. But instead of focusing on the soft power plays and match results, we take a broader look at the role football can have by bringing people together in our cities, and even how the decision to move a stadium by one team has rallied citizens about its future. All that, plus we find out about the world's only floating football pitch, hear about the environmental impact the World Cup had in South Africa, and much more. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck.
Oh, what a goal! Give that man a knighthood!
So welcome to this week's episode of The Urbanist. It's probably the first time that we've looked at football on the show, but the truth is that this sport can be very powerful when it comes to urbanism. For 90 minutes, at least, people gather around to watch a match together, be it in a cafe, public square, or a vast stadium. So, is this sport a unifying force? Well, we're going to find out. But to get us started, let's head to Madrid. Now, if you've ever moved house before, you'll know that it's an extremely difficult test of your strength and willpower. So spare a thought for Atletico Madrid's 120,000 club members who recently had to move all the way across town to their brand new stadium, the Wanda Metropolitano. And as our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous finds, the relocation has, quite predictably, also upset decades of ingrained sensibilities across the city map.
The beating heart of every club is its stadium. In the self-proclaimed capital of football, Madrid, it's not just the sacred green pitch and the seating that surrounds it that matters, but an entire central nervous system of adjacent plazas, bars, and shops selling team paraphernalia, which have embedded themselves into the urban fabric. This year, Madrid has more reason than ever to chant about being the football capital. Real Madrid took home their 13th Champions Trophy, while Atletico Madrid, the team renowned for croaking at every precipice of victory, shocked even their fans by winning the Europa League against Marseille. It's been a good year for the club, having traded their Vicente Calderon Stadium for Europe's newest state-of-the-art arena at the start of the season. But beyond the inaugural glare of the bright LED screens, the over-the-top fireworks and the 67,000 shiny new seats, which makes it Spain's third largest stadium, the fanfare about their new digs, the Wanda Metropolitano, has overshadowed just how traumatic the move has been. Not just for diehard colchoneros, that's the local lexicon for Atleti fans, but also for the residents and businesses, who have been forced to adjust to the relocation. For decades, Madrid has been divided by an invisible line of demarcation. The well-to-do Real Madrid fans lay claim to the city's north, while the rougher around the edges Atleti supporters dwell down south. The decision to uproot the club's beating heart from the banks of the Manzanares River was made over a decade ago. Sitting on the riverbank since 1966 after members funded the construction by pooling together small loans, a handshake between the club president, city council and commercial entities sealed a new deal, moving Atletico into Madrid's unfinished and unfulfilled Olympic Stadium near the airport. It took 10 years for them to make the move, but the north-south divide has suddenly become a less convincing north-east rivalry. It's been a shock to this historical showdown, and there's been plenty of teething problems too. With no metro station, fans are flocking to each match by car instead, clogging up the roads with bumper-to-bumper traffic and riling residents who aren't particularly fond of the club. The neighbourhood has been redefined by this imposing new structure and the rowdy masses drawn towards it with Mecca-like reverence. Back on the old home front, the community of Atletico-themed bars and shops, which have served as a second home for fans for half a century, are struggling to adjust to this new era of silence and desolation. Their spirits dampened by a sense of loss, this Riverside district suddenly finds itself scanning the field for a new identity. Adding insult to injury, the disruptive demolition process is set to begin very soon, ensuring a painful reminder of the new reality reverberates across the district each day. There is an inkling of hope on the horizon, though. Once the stadium comes down, several new residential housing complexes will rise up in its place, as well as a brand new park that will finally complete the last stage of the 10-kilometre-long Madrid-Rio River redevelopment. This neighbourhood's former lifeblood may have been pumped full of football fervour, but as the city adjusts to this new north versus east paradigm, residents in the south can at least look forward to enjoying greener pastures on this sacred ground, and perhaps enjoy a friendly kick of the ball on the grass without all those fanatical hooligans spoiling the fun.
A report there by our ball boy, Liam Aldous, in Madrid. Now, how many football stadiums have you been to or seen on TV? They're all pretty similar once you're inside, a somewhat round arena overlooking the playing field. In Singapore, however, things are slightly different. Andrew Muller tells us the story of the Float, the world's only floating football pitch. Here he is.
Singapore is the world's second most densely populated country, ceding the title of most congested only to the tiny principality of Monaco. Accordingly, when it comes to citing notably space-consuming new municipal amenities, such as sports stadiums, Singapore has needed to be inventive. When Singapore's national stadium was undergoing rebuilding in the first decade of the 21st century, the decision was taken to site its temporary replacement on the water. The result was The Float at Marina Bay, the world's largest floating stage and arguably the world's weirdest football stadium. The Float's strangeness, at least as a football field, is twofold. One, and there is, yes, a clue in the name, is that it floats, the 120-metre by 83-metre platform tethered to the seabed by six pylons. The other is that it has seating only along one side. The grandstand, which holds 30,000 people, give or take, is built on solid ground on Singapore's foreshore. The Float was not intended as a football ground, despite having almost exactly the requisite proportions. The original idea was that the Float would provide an appropriately spectacular setting, at least until the National Stadium was once again serviceable, for the parades and fireworks which celebrate Singapore's National Day every August. But the Float quickly became a much beloved addition to Singapore's streetscape. The stretch of road between the grandstand and the Float itself was one of the most spectacular sections of the street circuit when Singapore's nighttime Grand Prix was first staged in 2008. Shortly after that, the Float made its debut as a football venue, hosting a match in Singapore's Sunday League between Tuan Gimuk Athletic and VNNTU. The Float has since seen only sporadic use as a football ground. Aside from the oddness of having all of a given game's fans sitting on one wing, there's the hassle and expense of fencing off three sides of the ground to avoid having to swim after out-of-bounds balls. It has, however, won a permanent place in the hearts of locals. Late last year, it was announced that the float would be renamed NS Square and would become the regular heart of National Day celebrations and the site for parades and a gallery honouring Singapore's tradition of compulsory military service. It's obviously a good thing that the float is not to be dismantled or scuppered or whatever it is that one does with immense barges which have outlived their purpose. It has become one of those rare sporting venues which is an attraction in itself. But it would be a shame if it were never to host another football game. The float has self-evidently an atmosphere unlike any other such arena on Earth, and the spectacular marine and urban backdrop across the pitch from the grandstand means that even if you're watching the grimmest nil-all draw, there's always something to look at.
Well, that was Andrew Bunner in football boots, not Wellington boots, and this is The Urbanist. You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, and I'm your referee, Andrew Tuck. 8 years ago, it was Africa's turn to finally host the FIFA World Cup. South Africa hosted the 2010 tournament across 9 of its cities. It was a huge logistical undertaking in a continent that had never hosted this size of mega sporting event. But what were the lasting effects on the urban environments? Well, the urbanist Deborah Roberts studied the impact of the World Cup on South Africa, and she spoke with Monocle's Sheena Rossiter.
The problem is Africa is larger than most people in the North recognise. And that's the problem, is Africa literally spans so many climatic zones, all the way from tropical forest to the oldest desert in the world. So very different impacts. But I think the one thing we can talk to is obviously water scarcity is a big challenge for the majority of the countries on the continent, a big issue. Flooding and the increase of extreme events. And obviously, given our very extensive coastline, sea level rise is a big problem. But I would say at the top of Africa's agenda probably is its water agenda.
What were your conclusions from that paper that you wrote about greening and mega sporting events, namely the 2010 FIFA World Cup in South Africa?
I think the greening of these mega events poses really interesting questions in the sense that the predominant narrative in the world is the polluter must pay. And so we end up with a situation where the promoters of these events, who presumably would effectively be our polluter, actually leaves the host cities to pay. And that raises for me strong ethical questions about these mega events and their roles in cities. Obviously, they come in with the idea of strong economic development. But I think that economic face in some way disguises the environmental impact. And certainly that was our strongest learning, is that if we were true to the principles that our city has tried to adopt in all of its environmental work, looking at carbon neutrality, looking at biodiversity preservation and so on, the price tag that the city is left with is hugely significant and spans over decades. So, for example, the reforestation projects I spoke about, a couple of those were put in place to deal with the carbon neutrality commitments that the city wanted to adhere to in the hosting of these mega events. We will be responsible for these reforestation projects in perpetuity, which means the management, the obligation to adhere to them stays with us for the foreseeable future, whereas the people who promote that event have come and gone in our city. They've taken the profits and left us with the price tag. So, you know, from an environmental justice point of view, I have very strong questions now about the hosting of mega events and the value of those. And that situation may be more extreme in cities of the global south with fewer resources, but it really does raise ethical questions that I think these big sporting federations need to be addressing. And I think they need to take responsibilities for some of those, perhaps not all, because, I mean, obviously the host city will get benefits from hosting them, but I think there has to be a much firmer partnership around dealing with the environmental footprints of these events.
Is it concerning that IOC and FIFA are shopping around a lot of their mega events in the global south now? Is that concerning for an environmental perspective?
I think it has to be concerning for everyone. The new policy environment in the world that we saw effective from 2015 onwards with the Sustainable Development Goals, the new urban agenda, the Paris Agreement, really changed the debate. So if you looked at the Millennium Development Goals, they were really about development in the South. The SDGs say everyone has to be in. Paris Agreement says everyone has to be in. New Urban Agenda says every city has to be in, which means that this unequal division of responsibilities, particularly as it relates to the Global South, that has to be a thing of the past. So that's fine. I have no problem with some of these events being hosted in our parts of the world. We've got such a nice climate. Why wouldn't you want to be there? But I think it's that responsibility, that mindset, that we're all in. So yes, we're all in for the event and the benefits that brings, but similarly, we must all be in to deal with the consequences that are left after that event. And that's where I think we need to call out these large organizations, that you are simply not doing what you need to do in many of these cases.
They are seeming to be called out a bit more now. You know, Hamburg back down. Nobody wants to host the Winter Olympics anymore, apparently. Are they being called out enough?
I don't think so. But I think that's symptomatic not only of the mega events, but I think many of our activities at the global level are not being called out enough. I think this is an era of radical change where we need to transform the way we do things. And I think that's calling into question everything we do as a society, from the mega event right down to the micro activity of what a person does in their house. So certainly they are one element of the problem, but they're not the only element. And I think if we could create a broader momentum for societal change and transformation and responsibility and a more service-oriented mentality globally, the fact that we all need to help each other. We're on one planet with a unique set of very difficult challenges that we face. We would be able to create that momentum. But society has got to change its value system, because people can get away with not changing if society is complacent and is not demanding change.
How do you demand change in an era of fake news?
Well, you know, by sticking to your guns as a scientist and making sure that you get out good, reliable information that people can use. Because at the end of the day, individuals have to decide for themselves how they want to be in the world, how they want to act in the world. I mean, I think we're all bombarded by so many inputs these days. We've just got to make sure that products, particularly coming from the scientific world, are out there, they're accessible, they can be understood by people so people can evaluate for themselves. You know, I don't think we should think about the consumer of information as particularly handicapped. I think people are quite bright and can make their own decisions. But then we've got to have everything open and available. And I think that's the challenge for science, is that it has to be more out there in terms of being, here it is, this is what it means, this is how you access it. And depending on who you are, we can put it into your language so that you can make those evaluations yourself. So I think there's a big responsibility on the shoulders of scientists to reach out.
That was Deborah Roberts in conversation with Monocle's Sheena Rossiter. Slovenia didn't qualify for this year's World Cup, but they did make it to the tournament in 2010 after making their debut appearance in South Korea 8 years earlier. They played their home qualifying matches for that campaign in Bezigrad Stadium in the capital, Ljubljana. It's an unusual venue, one of the few in world football built before the Second World War and designed by a significant architect. But the stadium's fortunes have declined faster than those of the national team. It's been derelict since 2008, and development plans have come to nothing. It's a sorry tale of neglect, mismanagement, but also of gardening. Monocle's man in Ljubljana, Guy Delaunay, is at the stadium.
I know it probably sounds like I'm standing in the middle of a motorway, but I'm actually standing in front of a cultural monument of national importance that you wouldn't necessarily know to look at it. In fact, most people probably drive or cycle past this place without giving it a second glance. But the outsider perhaps has an advantage. When I first moved to Ljubljana, I wondered why there were neoclassical columns supporting a roof above a stretch of pavement on busy Dunajska Boulevard just outside the heart of the city centre. You can also see, if you just walk along the wall a bit, some windows similar to those you'd expect for buying tickets at, say, a railway station. And then the name of the adjacent bus stop is the real giveaway. It's simply called Stadion. And this isn't just any old stadium. It's a venue designed by Ljubljana's signature architect, Jože Plečnik. He's a figure considered so important in Ljubljana that if you go to the tourist information office in the city centre, you're unlikely to escape without being booked on a tour examining Plečnik's many buildings and innovations in urbanism. If you love Ljubljana's Triple Bridge, for example, that's Plečnik. If you're a fan of the city's many buildings inspired by the Italian Renaissance style, that's Plečnik too. Enjoying shopping at the covered market next to the Ljubljanica River? You know who to thank. Not for nothing is he known as the man who built Ljubljana, or Slovenia's Gaudi. So, of course, a sports venue designed by Plečnik is going to be revered in a country which has featured Plečnik and his works on its banknotes and even on contemporary euro coins. Bežigrad has been a cultural monument of national importance since 2009. So how has it come to be in the state that it's in today? Now, if I just stand up now and take a little peek through these gates, which I suppose would once have been opened when this was a working sports stadium, I can just peek through the bars and you can still see the stadium itself. Everything looks reasonably intact. You've got terrace seating all around in a bowl. It's a sunken bowl, so it'll be well protected from the elements. There's a lot of greenery now growing on the terrace seating. And then immediately opposite, there's a very neoclassical structure indeed. And I'll get to that later, because that's an important part of the history of this place. But otherwise, it's in a pretty sorry state. As the Talking Heads song goes, there are nothing but flowers inside the stadium now, where you used to have crowds of 10, 20,000 people watching national team football matches and attending many other important occasions. It's really been the venue for a lot of significant events in Slovenian history. Take sport, for example. The goal which took the national team to its first international tournament since independence was scored here. And bearing in mind it opened in the 1930s, it's seen plenty of less savoury events, like the mass pledge of loyalty to Nazi Germany in 1944. There were also religious ceremonies here as well in the pre-Second World War period. And getting back to that building I mentioned before, they used to hold an enormous open-air mass here, with the clergy presiding from the Glorieta, which is this kind of temple which I can see through the fence opposite me, with the neoclassical columns and a little balustrade around the top. That still looks pretty much intact, and you can view it today if you're willing to, I suppose, either peek through the bars or maybe be a bit more creative and find a way of shinning over the wall. But since 2008, the only thing this venue has witnessed is the growing of weeds on the terraces surrounding what used to be the athletics track and football field. There were grand plans to revive the stadium. The Bežigrad Sports Park was a public-private partnership, and it aimed to restore Plečnik's original features while adding retail and commercial buildings. Well, that's where everything fell down. Critics said the new buildings would dwarf the stadium, which is, after all, already sunken below ground level. But the real damage was done by the owners of the adjacent allotments. They didn't want to move their gardens, and a court found that the project didn't meet environmental protection requirements. So now the stadium rivals the allotments for the profusion of greenery, but it should and could all be very different. Ljubljana's made bold moves in urbanism in recent years, closing the city centre to private vehicles, upgrading bike paths, and creating new public spaces where there used to be car parks, and this has made the city a tremendous place for people to live as well as to visit. In that context, it's easy to see how Plečnik's Bežigrad Stadium would fit in, an outdoor city centre venue for sports, music, maybe skating in the winter. And unlike most stadiums, it would form part of a heritage trail. You never know, perhaps if football returned here, it might even improve the national team's fortunes.
Thank you, Guy. That was Monocle's very own Guy Delaunay. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Fancy Footwork Carlotta Rabello, and it was edited by the man with the striking kick, David Stevens. If you're an avid listener to Monocle 24, and we hope you are, you'll know that we have a man responsible for reading the music charts for us. So, following the intel provided by our very own striker, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, we play you out of this episode of The Urbanist with the best World Cup song of all time. Here's Shakira with Waka Waka, This Is Africa. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
You're a good soldier, choosing your battles. Pick yourself up and dust yourself off and back in the saddle. You're on the front line, everyone's watching. You know it's serious, we're getting closer, this isn't over. The pressure's on, you feel it, but you got it all, believe it. When you fold, get up, oh-oh, and if you fold, get up, eh-eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa, 'cause this is Africa.